Hi, this is Steve Nerlich.
Why cheap astronomy?
Yeah, why? And this is Dear Cheap Astronomy, episode 126, Going Deeper. After a decade or more of podcasting, it's hard not to revisit the same themes once or twice. So when you do, there's an opportunity to go a bit further, that is, a bit deeper. For example, Dear Cheap Astronomy, so what is the right message to send to the aliens? Keen listeners may be familiar with Cheap Astronomy's ongoing despair at Earth's lackluster attempts to communicate with the wider universe. A few episodes back, we ran through the history of our deliberate meta-communications, that is, messaging extraterrestrial intelligences, about 90% of which have been music. This assumes that aliens have ears and an atmosphere of roughly equivalent density to Earth's that would enable effective sound conduction. It also assumes that the aliens will be able to work out from first principles that the signals we sent are meant to be converted into audio, and then constructed the necessary equipment, and were then overwhelmed by hearing music from an alien species. I mean, maybe they'd be overwhelmed, but imagine the situation in reverse, where we received our first extraterrestrial and intelligent signal. The best minds in the world would spend years working through it, before hesitantly announcing that the aliens liked doing the ooby-dooby and wanted to let us know about it. I mean, it could still be profound for some. It is a genuine handshake across the light years. But surely a few of us are going to end up thinking, what, that's it? Couldn't they at least send through the specs for a fusion reactor? To be fair, Frank Drake and others have sent messages with a bit more hardcore science. But they do still all come down to just being conversation openers. We sent some prime numbers to indicate we know math, a depiction of Earth and the solar system, a DNA molecule, and the inevitable picture of a man and a woman holding hands. In sending such a message, we are inviting a response, which might be more math, a depiction of their planet, their reproductive coding molecule, and something from their own family album. So that's all great, but you're looking at several hundred years to send the message and an equivalent amount of time to get the reply. So if we don't want to spend millennia just exchanging business cards, maybe we should be trying to start a more interesting conversation. For example, let's skip the niceties and ask whether they've managed to harness fusion power, or whether they know how to cheaply and efficiently sequester CO2 within rocks. Or maybe they figured out a cheap form of artificial photosynthesis so we can turn our excess CO2 into glucose on an industrial scale, solving climate change and world hunger in one go. And if nothing else, maybe they have some good rocket engine designs to share. Keen Cheap Astronomy listeners would be aware that we think all the nervousness about identifying ourselves to malevolent aliens is kind of silly. After all, we have already broadcast our presence and provided our favourite song lists, so the damage is kind of done anyway. The key point is the speed of light means that whoever receives our message may only do so after it's hundreds of years old. So if it does turn out that they're evil aliens, all we've really done is to indicate where our technological development was hundreds of years ago, which is kind of like telling someone we have cannons when we actually have nuclear weapons. So, why not move beyond just saying, here we are, we know about prime numbers, and here's our favourite dance mix. Let's instead start some kind of transactional discussion. Show them what we've got, and ask them to reciprocate. Of course, the question then is, what have we got that's really worth anything to an alien species? We can't actually build a fusion reactor. Showing off our nuclear weapons is probably not the way to go, so 3D printers, high-efficiency batteries, planes, trains and automobiles? Whatever we do say, there is some risk of embarrassment, but we do have to start somewhere. So, why not keep the music, but use it as a backing track to an even richer story, and one that's about sharing.
This is the middle bit.
The next time someone starts a list of humanity's stupidest behaviours, like war and ever-increasing fossil fuel usage in the face of climate change, we suggest the addition of sending music to aliens. Of course, it partly happens because no one can really think what else to say apart from listing prime numbers. But anyway, let's now dig deeper into another issue that does actually involve digging deeper. Dear Cheap Astronomy, can we drill through the ice and find life on Europa? Firstly, it's worth noting there are quite a few moons out there with suspected subsurface oceans. So not only Europa, but also Ganymede and Callisto around Jupiter, then Enceladus and Dione around Saturn, and there's even a suspicion that Ceres, an asteroid rather than a moon, may also have one. But everyone gets excited about Europa because it's hot. Europa is the second large moon out from Jupiter after Io, and then Ganymede and Callisto follow. Io, the first moon out, is the most volcanic object in the solar system and would have long ago evaporated away any water that it might have had. It's so volcanic because its proximity to Jupiter means it's constantly being tidally stretched as it follows an elliptical orbit around Jupiter. Europa, the next moon out after Io, manages to retain water, which is thought to be in liquid phase beneath a 20-kilometer icy crust. Its surface looks fresh, presumably due to regular resurfacing, and has what looks like discoloured cracks where that discoloration might arise from liquid water seeping upwards to the surface and leaving some kind of sediment there. Ganymede and Callisto look more like hard frozen balls of ice and are both heavily cratered, suggesting they don't experience a lot of resurfacing. So it's Europa that gets the focus, not just because it's got a subsurface ocean, but because that ocean is probably also heated. Ganymede has a magnetic field thought to arise from a circulating subsurface and salty ocean, so Ganymede does have one, even though it may be under 150 kilometres of icy crust. Anyhow, we do think that the warmer Europa is a prime candidate for hosting life, where its hot and rocky core means there could be lots of hydrothermal vents pumping streams of hot nutrients into the subsurface ocean. That wording got strangely procreative just there, but that is kind of the whole idea. If you want life, you don't just need water, you need chemistry. Europa exploration planning is filled with ideas of drilling into its 20-kilometre icy crust so as to access the subsurface ocean, but we wouldn't want to suggest those ideas are necessarily good ideas. Europa's surface temperature is minus 160 degrees Celsius, which is pretty cold. So while a persistent heat source, like say a chunk of plutonium, might melt through the ice, if that chunk is just at the base of your robot probe, there's a risk the melted ice would refreeze around the top of the probe and lock it in place. Remember, Europa's surface gravity is a bit less than the moon, so there won't be a lot of downward pull. Therefore, you'd probably need to encase the entire probe in a plutonium shell in order to make any headway. And then, if you hit a sizable rock on the way down, that could be the end of the mission unless the probe can also move laterally. To achieve that, you'd need some kind of mechanical solution, since firing a rocket thruster in an enclosed space is just going to destroy the rocket, if not the whole probe. So maybe some kind of push piston would work, but it's also got to work without getting caught in refreezing ice. So you'd probably have to make the piston out of plutonium as well. And if there's lots of rocks along your 20-kilometre melt descent, all that lateral pushing is going to put a significant drain on your power reserves. Of course, these are all just engineering challenges to be overcome by lots of testing, trials, and ingenuity, as well as an absolute ton of money, time, and effort. But even once you are through to the ocean and start exploring, you then have the problem of how to transmit the data back out through 20 kilometers of ice. So either the robot has to steadily unreel a 20-kilometer transmission cable as it goes down, or it's going to have to bore its way back up again to send its data home. It's about here that we should remember those discolored cracks on the surface and the fact that we might have spotted a Europa water jet with the Hubble Space Telescope, much like the water jets that the Cassini mission discovered shooting out from Enceladus. So, rather than all the drilling nonsense, you could just do a flyby of Europa, sample one of the water jets, or otherwise land near one of the surface cracks, and just dig a little. Indeed, maybe it's not such a great idea to drop a huge chunk of plutonium into a pristine and potentially life-bearing subsurface ocean, even if it is in the name of science.
This is the end bit.
So, there you go. If you dig a little, there may be lots of exciting new things to discover. Although if you dig a lot, the whole exercise can become a little unfeasible, particularly if there's plutonium involved. Finding some kind of life beneath the ice of Europa, or finding intelligent life out there in the cosmos, would be quite something, although there are a lot of practicalities to think through first. But that's it for another episode of Dear Cheap Astronomy. If you've got a space science question, or you just want to note some practicalities, why not write to cheapastro@gmail.com and we'll do the stoicism for you. Thanks for listening. Steve Nerlich, Cheap Astronomy.